Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Nun Aleph Amud Aleph by the two dots. The Gemara is continuing to dissect the Mishnah about individuals who don't have a chazakah, one on the other. Mishnah says, "V'lo yisha v'nechzei ba'ala." Woman does not have the ability to establish a chazakah vis-a-vis the properties of her husband. Gemara says, "Pshita, why would you think she does have the ability to establish a chazakah?" Came indeed la mizone, because she has the right to mizonot, mizonehu dekachla. We're just going to assume the reason that there's no objection from the husband about her utilizing the field, taking the production of the field, is because she's collecting her mizonot. So if we have a way to ascribe the motives of her taking the fruits, and therefore it's not worthy of an objection, then you can't say that the lack of an objection establishes a chazakah over here. So there's no reason we should believe that this woman should be able to establish a chazakah on her husband's property, given the fact that there are obligations that exist between the husband and her, and those obligations would explain what she's doing on the field. It says, Lo tzricha, di'icha da'ara achrita de mizono. It was a case where he designated a particular property from which she should collect her mizonot. The Baal HaTosafot also quoted this on the top of Men Zayim Namud Bet, that in a situation where he's designated a particular property for her to collect her mizonot, then we would have thought that she can now establish a chazakah on other pieces of property. Given the fact that she has a particular property from which to take her mizonot, any other property where she exercises control should be an indication of a chazakah, or that she owns the property. The answer is, Kamash Malon, the Mishnah tells us that she still does not have a right to do this, because as the Rishbam says, a husband is not going to be so makpid on his wife if she takes a little more than she is deserving under the mizonot. Or in essence, the nature of a relationship between a husband and wife is that the husband is not so particular about what his wife is doing. If she's taking mizonot from another piece of property, if she's taking payroll from there, he's not going to be so makpid on it. That's along the lines with what Rabbeinu Gershom is saying, which is, the baal gabi ishto shatik. A husband doesn't say something to his wife. It's the nature of the relationship. And therefore, we don't expect him to object. And his lack of objection is not an indication that she really owns the property or that she has some sort of chazakah on the property. So here, too, the Gemara asks the same question asked with regards to the husband. Hara'aya yesh. Just like we said by the husband, the inability to establish a chazakah implies that you do have an ability if you had a shtar to establish ownership over here. And that means if the woman shows up with a shtar mechira, showing that her husband sold her the property, that we would grant her the property. She can't use a chazakah in lieu of proof. But that means if she does have evidence of the fact that there was a sale, there was an exchange of some sort, then we would believe her. Lema ligluye zuzei hu debayi. Wait a minute. Maybe there is an ulterior motive over here that precipitated the shtar or the mecher. And that is, the husband is looking for money that his wife is hoarding. He's afraid that his wife is hoarding money, unbeknownst to him, whether she's stealing from him or whether she's receiving money from other locations or sources which she is entitled to. So the only way for him to discover the money is to create this fictitious sale so that it exposes her money. She wants to do something with the money, so he says, listen, I'll sell you the property and you'll pay me for it. That way she'll show up with the money and he'll know whether she has this cash or doesn't have this cash. Given the fact that that could be the motive behind any sale from the husband to the wife, how can we rely on a document of sale to tell us that the woman really bought the property? Maybe it was simply a premise or a ploy to discover this hidden money that she was hoarding. From this you would conclude that a person who sells a field to his wife, kanta, she has a kinyan on the field, meaning you will be successful at selling the field, or she will be successful in acquiring the field. V'lo amrinan l'glulei zuzei hu debayi. And for this you would conclude that we don't worry about this issue. So the Gemara asks the question, but given that our Mishnah says that she does have the ability to show evidence and say the field is hers, that implies that we don't worry about the veracity of the contract, or whether the contract was really made for a sale versus discovery of money. And so therefore the conclusion to this question, which will be asked later on, is that fine, it goes through. Where it says, though, Don't say that. Don't say that that's the conclusion, but rather, Ema haraya yesh bishtar matana. Now that raya, or the ability for her to show evidence of the fact, is talking about a shtar matana. When you give something, it's different than a sale. And when you're selling something, then you could possibly think that the reason he's selling the property is to discover the money. So there you have two possibilities. Either he really sold it to her, or he sold it to her in order to discover the money. Given that, you would be possibly a good sale if she really had the money independently, which seems unusual, or less likely. On the other hand, if he's discovering money, it's clearly not a sale because he was trying to get the money out from her. He wasn't really trying to sell the property. And then by a matana, you can't say that. By gift, there is no consideration for the gift. Therefore, if she has a document indicating that she received this as a gift from her husband, we will believe that document because there's no reason to suspect otherwise. It can't be for the discovery of money. And so that's what our Mishnah means. Our Mishnah means that if she shows up with a document of gifting, that document will be binding and she'll have the right to that property. Amrlei Rav Nachman the Ravuna. So Rav Nachman tells Ravuna, Lo avamar gaban b'urta. You weren't by us last night. B'tchuma. Within the tchum. Damrinan milei malyoto. Because over there we said some great things that you missed. Within the tchum, the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom explains here is, Toch tchuma means within the Beit Midrash, because the Beit Midrash was out in the fields, and that's what he meant by toch tchuma. The Rishbam assigns more meaning to that in his statement that they used to keep the Beit Midrash on the edge of the tchum, and that way people could reach there on Shabbat from multiple locations, from multiple different directions. It would be within the range of tchum Shabbat, so they would place it in a strategic location that allowed people to get there on Shabbat. She says, you missed out in the Beit Midrash, that which we said. What exactly was the big chiddush? What was the big news in the Beit Midrash that I missed? It says that a mocher sadeh l'ishto kanta. Person who sells a field to his wife, she successfully acquires it. Velo amrina neglulei zuzehu debaye. And we don't say, or we don't ascribe ulterior motives to the sale by the husband that is really trying to discover the money of his wife. Amalei, so Rav Huna says back to Rav Nachman, what type of chiddush is that? Pshita. That is a pretty straightforward halacha. We didn't need your chiddush when the Beit Midrash to teach us that. Dal zuzei me'acha. If you drop the cash, v'tiknei b'shtara. She at least should have the ability to acquire it through a shtar. So the way that the Rashbam explains it over here is, when you're speaking about money, or the exchange of money as being the mechanism for kinyan, then you could speak about l'glulei zuze, that he's trying to expose this hidden money. On the other hand, gabei shtar mechira lo sheach lemeimar hachi. When you're using a shtar, or you're using a shtar to evidence the sale, through that you cannot expose capital, because the shtar is the mechanism of kinyan, doesn't require the exposure of the money, or the money to be paid. The way the Rashbam continues on to explain it is that nobody thinks of these far-fetched types of machinations in order to get the money back or the hidden money. In fact, they wrote a shtar. That's not part of the fiction or the ploy. That already gives tokef, gives strength to the fact that there was a real transaction over here. He doesn't have to write her a shtar. And don't tell me that the only way she would sell it to him is if he wrote a shtar. That's not true. Because if he wrote a shtar, it's already an indication of a real sale and not simply an exposure of money. You could have argued the woman was unwilling to expose the money or to agree to the sale unless she got a document evidencing the sale. Rashbam says that's too far. This thing's all a ploy or all a fiction to try to get the money out. He's not going to go so far as to sign a document and bring in legal documents. The fact she has a legal document evidencing the sale, that already puts us beyond the pale of this being a discovery of money and rather must be a real sale. On the other hand, the Balei Tosafot over here speak about the possibility of depending on when the shtar was given. He says, first of all, b'makom shekotvim shtar hayu. He says, this is in a place where they write a shtar. Because certain locations did not have the minhag to write a shtar. So obviously we're speaking about a place where the minhag is to write a shtar. And given that the minhag is to write a shtar, then the shtar can create a binding kinyan even without the exchange of money. So that would be the mechanism of kinyan, and it would work even without the money being present, without the money exchanging hands. And so that would prove to you that this must have been a real sale and not a discovery of money, because money wasn't integral to the kinyan that was created. So he says, in a place where they write a shtar, he says, your whole memra is meaningless, because the fact that they write a shtar already indicates that there is a mechanism for kinyan independent of the kesef. He says that maybe even in a place where they write a shtar, there might be a nafkamina, and that's the following. If the sale was premised on either the shtar or the kesef being the means of acquisition, in that case, you can acquire through the money, even though there was not a shtar written, or inami kigon shekotav shtar tchila. They wrote the shtar first, va'achar kach nitna damim, and then afterwards they give the money. Diamar legulei zuzehu debayi lo kanta. Because in that case, if he says, I'm coming to expose the money, she would not acquire it. So what the Balei Tosafot point out, unlike the Rashbam, is that the Rashbam says you never have to write a contract. If he wrote the contract, that's clearly an indication that there was a kinyan over here. The Balei Tosafot say you have to look at the circumstances. Circumstances would determine as to whether the shtar is functioning as a kinyan, or the shtar is there to draw out the cash. And so that depends on how it was worded. Given that the shtar can be either absolutely necessary to get the kesef, and therefore, if in a place where they always give the shtar first and then get the cash, he could argue, I gave the shtar in order to expose the kesef. Or in a case where either kesef or shtar is the mechanism, and you could do either one, whichever one you want first, then if the kesef came about, then there would be no shtar. And says there's no shtar, then you can't say, take away the kesef, now there's a shtar, there is no shtar over here. So the Balei Tosafot do come up with scenarios whereby, even if you have a shtar, it wouldn't necessarily indicate that it's lo degluye zuze. So the Tosafot points out that even after this statement of Rav Huna, Rav Nachman's position isn't always not relevant, because there might be times where it is relevant, even in a place where they always write a shtar. Obviously, in a place where they don't write a shtar, and he wrote a shtar, that's clearly an indication of a real sale, because it was completely unnecessary. But even in a place where they do write a shtar, there are certain times where the shtar either is not necessary, or the shtar is absolutely necessary to get the cash out. And in those situations, he could argue, the gluye zuze, that I either was coming to expose the capital, or the writing of the shtar was unnecessary, therefore, it's clear that it was given for a kinyan. So Tosfot sees a more nuanced difference in their opinions over here, rather than the Rashbam who says, anytime there's a shtar, it's clear that it wasn't the gluye zuze. Milotnan. Don't we have a Mishnah? Nechasim sheish lemachrayut, diknim bekesef ushtar b'chazakah. That when it comes to real property, you can acquire it in one of three manners. Kesef, through the purchase, the money. Shtar, the writing of a shtar that indicates that there was a kinyan over here. U'b'chazakah, chazakah is not like the chazakah that we've been speaking about here but 3 years, but it's a demonstration of ownership, which means you go down and you put up a fence, you break down a fence, you lock a door, you dig in the ground. You do some action that indicates you've taken possession of the item. So Amar Leih, sort of Nachman says back to him, V'lav Yitmar Allah. Don't we have a qualification of that statement that Amar Shmuel, Lo Shanu Ela Bishtar Matana? That's only true when you're talking about a gift. Aval Bishtar Mecher, Lo Kana, Chitain La Demel. But a Shtar Mecher doesn't work until the cash changes hands. So in a case where you have a Shtar acquiring a property, the acquisition is not complete until the cash exchange hands. So therefore, the shtar is not an indication then of acquisition or a kinyan, because you take away the cash, there is no kinyan anymore. So the cash would be essential for the kinyan, and therefore you can't indicate that the shtar is the mechanism for acquisition. Where you can say that is by shtar matana. So once you've done that, now we're back to the chiddush of Rav Nachman, which is, if there is a shtar, we say it's lo legluye zuze, a mocher sedel ishto kantav lo minin gluye zuze, that is a chiddush. That we say that the transaction goes through and he's not exposing the capital, because Rav Huna's ha'ara, that the shtar would hold the acquisition together even without the kesef, that's just not true. Because a shtar won't hold the glue together of the transaction when there's a necessity for cash. Cash then becomes the closing part of the deal, and the shtar in of its own is not sufficient to create an acquisition over here. V'lav motiv Rav Amnuna. So Rav Huna responds to Rav Nachman, says, wait a minute. Shmuel's statement, didn't Rav Huna question that from a braita? B'shtar ketzad. What is an example of using a shtar as a vehicle for a kinyan? Katablo al niyar al cheres. He wrote it on paper or on cheres, on pottery or a shard of pottery. Afo pi shein bo shaveh pruta. Even though the item itself doesn't have an inherent value to it, if he writes on that, sadai mechuralach, sadai knuyalach, that my field is sold to you, my field is now given in acquisition to you, harizo mechura b'tinutuna, that is a good sale, that is a good gifting of the property to the individual. You hear, you see an example of a shtar being not only a shtar matana, but also a shtar mechira. It says, v'lav hu motiv la v'hu mefarikla. Didn't Rav Amnuna raise the question, but also answer the question, which is, b'mocher sadehu mipnei ra'ata. It's a case where he's selling the field because it's so bad, because it's such a poor piece of property. He found a buyer for it. He's so excited that he has a buyer for it, that he has gemir at the dot, even without the cash exchanging hands. Or there are two more different ways to express it. The way that the Rishbam expresses it is he's just happy to have the deal closed and he'll get the cash later. He'll settle the cash later. He just wants it locked in immediately because he was able to sell the property finally, or he got rid of this low quality property, and therefore he wants the deal sealed immediately with the shtar. So that's why it works over there, but not in a classic sale case. It's only in this unique sale case. Others say that when he sells it, mipnei roa, it's the equivalent of a matana. It's similar to a gift, because he just wants it out of his possession. So it's as if he's gifting it to him, and then he'll collect the cash or get the cash later. So because of that, the only thing we're speaking about where a shtar is the mechanism for kinyan is when we're talking about a matana. We're talking about a mecher, a shtar on a standalone basis will not be the vehicle for acquisition. You'll need the cash to come in to become the kinyan. And so if that's the case, Rav Huna is incorrect. If you take away the cash, you do not have a kinyan with the shtar. And that's what makes Rav Nachman's statement from the Beit Midrash, a chidush, which is that when the woman shows up with the shtar, we assume that she did acquire the property, despite the fact that you could have made a claim of Ligluye Zuze, that he was just trying to expose the capital, or the hordes of cash that she possibly had. We don't say that, and we uphold the contract to say that she did purchase the property from her husband. Now, just as a sidebar over here, it's interesting that the braita that we quote says that the underlying contract, it does not have to be worth a pruta. That's number one. And number two is that it could be written on niyar v'cheres. So here the Balei Tosafot raise an issue, which they also raise in Gittin itself, which is the fact that how could you write on something that is mizdayef, something that could be made into a forgery, which is cheres, when you write on it and you erase on it, or niyar, which is paper that was already used and erased already. It's not clear then that when the contract is written on it, that there's not a forgery of some sort. Because even if there was an erasure of that which was there and the numbers or the information was replaced, you wouldn't know about it. And given that, we will not allow you to write on paper or cheres, which is something that can be easily forged or have the information changed. So why over here are we allowing you to write a contract on these items? So the answer that the Baya Tosafot give is that this is according to Rabbi Elazar, who believes Ede Mesira Karte, that the Edim that make the transaction effective are the Edim that witness the transaction. But according to Rabbi Meir, in Ochanami, Rabbi Meir says that the signatures of the Edim are the thing that makes the transaction valid. You would not be able to use these materials because these materials can be forged. And Rabbi Meir requires that the contract be able to be mochiach mitocho, is the terminology that we use, that it should be self-evident from the contract that this is true. And in a case where you're using materials that can be forged on, it's not self-evident from the contract or from the item because it might be that the whole thing is false. Given that, Rabbi Meir would say that these materials cannot be used. And the Baal Tosafot suggests that this Gemara must be according to Rabbi Elazar, who says that Ede Misira Karte. And then the Baal Tosafot go on to say that don't we have a Memra back in Daf Kof Bet in Gittin where Rabbi Elazar is only Machshir by Gittin, and immediately, but not in other Shtarot. So that would mean that over here where you have a different Shtar, even Rabbi Elazar would say that there is a problem. The Baal Tosafot go on to explain that when it says over there that Rabbi Lazar thinks that this is true of Gittin, it's not limited to Gittin. It means Gittin and anything looks like a get. So what is a shtar that looks like a get? That's a shtar that is utilized like a get to effectuate whatever it is that you're trying to do. A get is not necessarily a document of ra'aya, of proof. It can be used in that function as well, but the primary purpose of the get is to get divorced. And so therefore the document is the vehicle for the divorce. So he says any contract that looks like a get, which means that it's the vehicle for the kinyan, that contract can be signed even on stuff that could be forged because it's the eidah de mesira that are karteh. Where you can't use a document like this is in a case where it's a shtaraya, where it's a document to evidence whatever transaction happened, then you can't write it on materials that can be forged, because the whole point of that is to keep it around to be a raya. And if you could forge it, then you can change the proof text, and that's problematic. You could change the documentation, that's problematic. To effectuate the kinyan, whatever's in front of us is what effectuates the kinyan. It doesn't matter that it can later be forged. It's whatever is transpiring right now that matters. That's one of the way the Tosfot answers. The other way that the Tosfot answers is there's a possibility that these materials are used in such a manner that they can't be forged. So instead of writing on the cheres, you etched it onto the cheres. Now, if you etch it onto the cheres, that can't be forged because an erasure there then would be noticeable or visible. So there are ways to use these materials in a way that they can't be forged. Don't use them in the standard way that you did or that people write. Then there are ways to come up with it and not be forged. So those are the two things that Tosfot notes over here. The second thing you have to understand is why is it less than a shaveh pruta meaningful over here? So by kiddushin, you're speaking about kiddushin, there's a relevance of saying that the document is worth less than a shaveh pruta, because by kiddushin, there's a requirement for a minimum value of a pruta. So what you show, or by the statement that the shtar is worth less than a pruta, is that when you use a shtar for kiddushin, it's not focused on the inherent value of the shtar itself, but rather on the shtar itself creating the kiddushin and not the value of the shtar. But over here, when we're talking about a transaction, why does it matter that the shtar is worth less than a pruta? The Baal Tosafot speculates that there were some who suggested it's because maybe you would think that the shtar is being used as a kinyan chalipin, and therefore it would require a pruta's worth in there in order to generate the kinyan chalipin. The Baal Tosafot say that that's incorrect, because over here, the kinyan chalipin doesn't work because the shtar is being given by the mocher, by the seller. If the shtar was being used as a chalipin, it would be the buyer who's giving the shtar in exchange for the property that he's taking from the mocher. It wouldn't be the mocher who's the one who's drawing up the shtar and giving it to the koneh. So given that, it can't be speaking about a case of a kinyan chalipin. So the main approach to answer this question is brought by the Ramban, which is that you would have thought that the shtar, in order to be considered chashuv, or significant enough to generate the transaction, would have to be shaveh pruta. So for the shtar to take on significance, it itself would have to be significant. What the Braita comes to teach you is that, despite the fact that it lacks an inherent value to it, it nevertheless can effectuate the transaction, because shtar is one of the mechanisms for kinyan, and it's not important that it has inherent value to it. Or the Ritva explains that it is based on the paradigm of get, whereby a get, we require a minimum value of a pruta to the get, so maybe you would have extrapolated that to other contracts, and that's what this Bright is coming to sell us, that that's not the case, that you don't need it to have a shaveh pruta, despite the fact that a get has that requirement of a shaveh pruta. Right, so those are two little harot on this point. But in the end, what we come to is this chiddush of Rav Nachman, that in the case where the woman shows up with this document of sale, we believe her and we do not assume that the husband was doing it in order to expose her cash or hordes of cash. And so therefore we will grant her the rights to the property. Rav Ashi Amar, b'matana b'kesh litna lo, v'lama katav lo b'lishon mecher, k'dei liapot kucho. So Rav Ashi says the answer to the problem of the braita that Rav Amnuna brought is not what Rav Huna said over here, that he's selling it mipnei ra'ata, but rather Rav Ashi says it's a case where it was also a matana. It was a gift. Well, if it's a gift, then why are we talking about saying mechira? It says because he gave the gift like a mechira, like a sale, in order to strengthen the position of the recipient of the gift. The way that the Rashbam explains it is that in this contract he wrote, Sadai mechuralach, Sadai netunalach. My field is sold to you, my field is gifted to you. He wrote both languages into the contract in order to give him the power of both being a sale and a gift. And as the Rashbam points out, my nafkamina, the nafkamina is that when you sell something, you sell it with recourse. The individual bought it now has recourse against you and can come and collect if it's taken away by a bal chova, by another party. So this gifter wants to give that right to the giftee. So he does that by saying, it was sold to you, so therefore you have recourse against me. That's number one. Number two is, why does he tell him it's gifted? Because gifts are exempt from the din of dinah debar metzra. Gifts are not subject to the first right of refusal that neighbors have to property that is sold. Because in a case where you have a mechira, since the individual either could purchase the property somewhere else, or he has recourse against the baalim, when the bar metzra, when the neighbor who borders on that property comes and takes it and compensates for it, the buyer doesn't lose. Number one is because he could buy property somewhere else. And number two is he'll get refunded the cash or provided another property by the seller. The other hand, when you're gifted a property, then if the neighbor goes and takes the property, you're not going to get a replacement property. This person gave one gift. He doesn't have multiple gifts to give. And you can't replace this. You can't go get a gift somewhere else. This is the gifted property that you received. So it's one thing to have dinah debar metzra where the buying party doesn't lose out. We don't cause him a loss. Because the whole point of dinah debar metzra is a din of lifnim mishurat hadin, vasita yashar v'atov. Do the right thing when you can. Well, you can do the right thing as long as it's not the expense of someone else. But if you do the right thing at the expense of someone else, so therefore there's no asita yashar tov for the other individual, we're not going to exercise din debar metzra. So in order to empower this giftee with both positions, both sadai mechura lach, that it's a mechira and you have recourse against me, as well as the fact that there's no din debar metzra, he wrote sadai netunalach. He wrote both languages into the contract. The Baalei HaTosafot take up issue with this Rashbam on two fronts. One is, he says, I don't like the fact that the language is written in Sadai mechuralach, Sadai netunalach. Why do you have the word Sadai in there twice? You could have written Sadai netunalach umechuralach. Why do you have to have Sadai both times? And number two is, I don't see you writing a contract that has both languages written in it. I don't like that. And therefore, the way that the Baalei Tosafot say it is that he gifted them the property, but wrote it as a shtar mechira. So it's not that both languages are found there, but rather there was a gift, but he put the language of mechira in it to empower him to have the rights of a mechira. Or the Tosafot offers an alternative, which is that he gave him two contracts. This is what we saw in Bava Metzia, when Rashi gave the same explanation that the Rashbam gave over here. The Baalei Tosafot thought, no, that he gave him two contracts. One contract that said it was a sale, one contract that said it's a gift. And therefore he can pull out whichever contract he needs at whatever time. If the property is confiscated from him, he'll pull out the mechira to get recourse. If it's a neighbor coming and saying, I have first right of refusal, he'll pull out the gift contract, and he'll be able to protect himself. The Baalei Tosafot then questioned the other premise of the Rashbam, which is, what's the value of it being a gift? The Rashbam says the value of giving a gift is that it protects you from dinah debar metzra. He says that's not true. The Gemara in Bava Metzia says that if you give a gift with recourse in it, that is not exempt from the dinah bar metzra. That's because basically what you did was effectively couch the sale in the form of a gift. Because once you give the gift with recourse, then the giftee won't lose if the bar metzra exercises his first right of refusal. He has recourse against the gifter and can go get another property or get his cash in lieu of the gift. So given that fact, when you gift with recourse, we don't classify it as a gift anymore because you're not going to lose if the dinner bar mitzvah exercises its right, as well as the fact that it starts to look like a sale and not like a gift anymore. So therefore the Tosafot says that can't be the nafkamina of a gift here because there's recourse based on the fact that it was a sale as well. So he says the nafkamina is how we read the contract. A contract of sale, we say a person sells something in a miserly fashion. We'll see later on, it's a machloket as to whether a person sells the ayin ra or ayin tov. But assuming that a person sells something in the most miserly fashion, when it comes to a matana, we assume that he gives in the most generous fashion. So the nafkamina would be, if we declare it a gift, that we would assume, if there are things that are ambiguous here, we'd assume in favor of the recipient, because we would think that he gifted in the most generous fashion rather than a sale. So that's what the Tosfot says is the nafkamina between mechira and matana. So whether you believe like the Rashbam or the Balei Tosafot, what Rav Ashi is pointing out is that the Braita that says that a shtar can be the mechanism for kinyan is not talking about a regular case of mechira. It's not talking about matana and mechira, which Rav Nuna then said was a mechira of something that was ra'ah, a bad piece of land, and therefore he just wanted it off his hands. But rather, it's all about a matana. So then why did we mention mecher? Because he gave the matana as a mecher. In order to strengthen the hand of the giftee, he called it a mecher, even though it really was a matana. And that's what's meant by that braita that we brought before. But once again, that would leave Rav Nachman's chiddush intact, because Rav Huna's proof is no longer a proof that a shtar would stand independent of the kesef, because we always say that kesef backs up a shtar, elayim kain, it's a matana, where the shtar can stand on its own. And you can see that there is an alternate girsa over here in the parentheses, which some Rishonim explain as the way to read the Gemara is Rabibi Misayim Ba Mishmei de Rav Nachman, which means that's a continuation of the previous answer, and this explains what he was doing. That he did it as a sale, but wrote it as a matana, because he wanted it out of his hands as fast as possible. He wanted the acquisition to happen immediately, so that the individual couldn't back out of it, because he was selling the property that was such a bad quality or difficult property to sell. Meitavet. Is this really true that when the woman shows up with a document, we believe that there was a sale here, and we don't suspect the fact that the husband was plumbing for the cash? Lavamina evet, he borrowed money from his slave. Vishikhriro, and then he frees him. Mina isha, he borrows from his wife. Vigirsha, and then he divorces her. Ein lahen alav klum, they have no rights to go and collect from him. So the evet who lent him money, and the woman who lent him money, he has no obligation to repay them once he frees them and they become independent, or he releases the woman through a get. My time, huh? Why shouldn't he be obligated to pay them? The reason that he's doing this is trying to expose capital that they are hiding. So he borrows, quote-unquote, money from them to figure out if they have this money. He has no intention of paying back the money. He's simply getting the money from them, which he believes is his own money. Because while the woman is under his auspices, or the evid is under his control, then in that case, everything belongs to the Baal, belongs to the husband, or to the Adon, to the master. And so he's trying to expose things that they've taken from him so that he gets his stuff back. It says, no, Hashani Hotam, over there it's different. Person doesn't want to put himself into a precarious position of being a borrower. Because we know the expression in Mishlei, which the Gemara uses on a halachic basis in a number of places, which is that the loveh is an eved to the ishmaveh, which means that the loveh, the borrower, always has the worst situation, or the creditor gets to dictate the terms because the loveh is the desperate one over here. So a person who, in a relationship, doesn't want to put himself into a position by which, after the fact, he will remain a eved or subservient to these individuals through a loan that was extended to them. So now that could be for one of two reasons. One is the fact that the nature of their relationship now, the husband versus the wife, the owner versus the eved, the position of the husband or the adon in this case is to quote unquote be the master. So now he doesn't want to swap places and then become the eved where the tables are turned on him. So that's one way to express it. The other way to express it is simply that he doesn't want this problem to persist after he frees the slave or he divorces the woman, because then his relationship after the divorce or after the freeing of the slave will flip their relationship around, and he doesn't want to be in that predicament. So therefore, he won't enter himself into a transaction that puts him in that precarious position. So we will assume that when he borrowed the money, he was doing it to expose the cash that was hidden. That's what the Tosfot says over here. Tema, d'mai rebuta naka b'shichro v'girsha. What's so important about the fact that he freed them or he divorced them? It's a pshita. T'mein lehem alav klum bo'odo tachtav. They have no claim against him while they're under his auspices. Gam sh'yotzim in lehem alav klum. Then when he divorces the wife or he frees the slave, they still have no rights of claim against him. If there was never a claim, the claim doesn't just suddenly appear after he frees them. That maybe they gave them the money, or they lent the money with the assumption that once they reached a point of independent ownership, that then they would have a right of collection. So that you could see a structuring of a situation in which being freed or divorced would give them then independent ownership, and that would cause the obligation to go into effect based on that. And so we don't say that. That's what Tosafot says. That's the chiddush here, that we don't say that, and we assume that when he borrowed, he was looking for cash. And what's clear from here is that if he borrowed money that was known to him, then you can't make the claim of Luye Zuze, and he would have to repay them. So this is only in a case where the borrowed money is coming from money that was not known to him. And that'll be something that we see later on at the end of the sugya, the differentiation between money that he knows about and money that he does not know about. Although if you believe that the reason that Eved Love, the Ishmalve, is a reason for not considering it to be a full-fledged loan of yours because he doesn't want to be put in that upside-down position with his Eved or with his wife, then even if the monies were known about, we would still say that the loan is unlikely a real loan because he would have borrowed from third parties before he borrowed from his wife for his Eved because of the nature of their relationship would have made it hard for him to borrow from them vis-a-vis borrowing from third parties. He would favor third parties over borrowing from them. And so therefore, we would not believe that the transaction happened, even if he knew about the monies that they were lending to him. Aval, when it comes to a mecher, we won't say that. By a mecher, where he gets remuneration for what he is selling, he's not putting himself in that precarious position of being Eved Love Ish Malve, and maybe he with a full heart sold the property to these individuals, and was not doing it to discover the cash. And so therefore, this isn't a question on Rav Nachman, because this is in a case of borrowing. Borrowing is different than a sale. By borrowing, we would agree that we worry about he's looking for cash rather than really borrowing the money. This is a case of a sale where we assume he's doing the sale on a full-fledged basis and not trying to expose the cash. Shalach Rav Huna Ba'avin. So Rav Huna Ba'avin sent Hamucher Sadeh Lishto Kanta. Someone who sells a field to his wife, Kanta. Ubal Ochel Peirot. But the husband still has a right to eat the peirot, to eat the output of the field, meaning like any other piece of property that she gets possession of, whether she brought into the marriage as nichsei milog, or she inherited while they were married. The principal belongs to the woman, but the output of the production of the field belongs to the husband. So similarly over here, where he grants her a right of ownership in the property, he's granting her the right of ownership like any other piece of property that she would get. And that means that he retains the rights to the peirot, but he's granted her the principal ownership of the property. Biram. But nevertheless, the truth is, Rabbi Ava, Rabbi Abau, b'chol g'dolei ador, all these other individuals, Rabbi Ava, Rabbi Avu, and all the g'dolei ador, amru, b'matana b'kesh litnola, he really wanted to gift it to her. The lama katav la, shum mecher, so then why did he write it as a sale? K'dei liyapot et kocha, to give her the upper hand in a claim later on. So what these individuals are saying is that he really gifted her the property. And as we said before, when you gift something, you gift it in the most generous fashion. That means when he gifted the property, not only did he gift her the principal of the property, he also gifted her the peirot, or the output of the property. Or the assumption is, according to the Rashbam, that this woman probably doesn't have money. And therefore, when he wrote a shtar mechira, we're going to interpret that shtar mechira is being a shtar matana because of the fact that it's unlikely that a sale actually took place because she doesn't have assets of her own. And that's why we assume it is a matana and reinterpret the mechira and the shtar to be a mechira liyapot et kocha. So here you have what seemingly is a fundamental machloket about a sale to a wife. If a husband sells the property to the wife and she shows up with a document of sale, how do we view the document of sale? But Rav Ba'avin suggests that we look at it as a sale. It's like any other piece of property that she would have acquired during her marriage, that the husband is entitled to the output and the peirot, and the woman keeps control of the principal or the underlying ownership of that property. On the other hand, Rabbi Abba, Rabbi Abo, B'chok Dolei Ador say, when he transacted with her, he didn't really transact with her, he gifted her the property. Why does she have a document that says it was sold? Because the sale will make it that she has now a stronger claim, she has recourse. She has other things that will be helpful to her if it's documented as a sale rather than as a matana. So here you have a fundamental machloket as to what happens when the husband sells it. Now both of these are premised on Rav Nachman's position, which is that when you have a wife showing up with a document of sale evidencing a purchase of property from her husband, we believe that it is a real purchase. It's not a discovery of the hoarded cash. And the only question that we have is, how much did he give to her? Did he sell it to her like a regular sale, or did he gift it to her and write it as a sale? Now the Gemara says, Meitavei. And here the Gemara brings the same question that we had in the previous Memra, and that's what the Rashbam points out over here, which is that they asked the same question, meaning the Braita that seemingly was problematic, they brought it up against both Memra. They brought it up as the Memra before, and now they're bringing about the Memra that we're bringing over here. So even though it's a repeat, when each of these Memra were raised in the Beit Midrash, they also raised this question from the Braita, which is, Lava mina evit v'shichroro, mina isha v'girsha. He borrowed money from his slave and then freed him, or he borrowed money from his wife and divorced her. In lahem alav klum. They have no claim against him. My time. Oh, what's the reason? La mishum damre de gluye zuzeu de bay. He wants to expose the words of cash or the money that they're hiding from him. So why don't we say the same thing here by the mecher? Why don't we say it's to expose the capital? Shani hatam, dololish ve'inish, evid lo ve'lish malvet. The same answer that we gave before, that a person doesn't want to put himself into that predicament. As the Baal HaBeit HaTosafot point out over here, the woman is the relevant aspect over here, where we differentiate between a loan and a mecher. Because by the loan, we will say he's using that to discover the hidden cash. Whereas by a mecher, we would not assume that's the case. We would assume that it was a full-fledged sale. On the other hand, by an evid, it doesn't really matter whether it was a loan or a sale. Because if you lent money to the evid, then we're going to say now he was trying to discover the cash. But even if you sold the property to the evid, mashakan evid, kanarabo. So if that's the case, then even if you sold it to him, it would still be your ownership and the sale would be invalid as well. So the only person where you would differentiate between a loan and a sale is the woman, where she could have independent ownership of the husband. I should also note here that the Rabbeinu Tam was very bothered by the girsa that we have in our Gemara. Because Rav Huna Ba'avin makes a statement, and then he says right afterwards, Baram, truthfully, everybody argues on me. Why would you ever bring a position down, and then right after that, quoting your position, you bring evidence to the fact that your position is meaningless because everybody in the world argues on your position. It's basically a dat yachid against the dat rabim, and Allah is not going to be like him. So why would he have quoted it that way? So the Rabbeinu Tam actually alters the girsa, and first of all, drops the word Baram. It says that Baram doesn't belong here, and therefore the reading would be, Rav Huna Bar Avinah Mukhasadel Ishto Kanta Balochel Perot, Rabbi Abba, Rabbi Avau, Bechog Gedor Amru, Bimakandana, Nibikesh Litnola, Vilama Katav Lalushum Mecher, Kdele Yapot Ed Kocho, to strengthen his position. So yes, he wanted to give it as a gift, so why did he write it as a sale? Because in a sale, he would retain rights to the Perot. And so he wrote it as a sale in order to maintain his rights to Perot, and that would be a corroboration of Rav Huna Bar Avin's position, which is that when you sell the property, you maintain the rights to the Perot. And that's why he's bringing their statement to back up what he's saying, that when it's a mecher, it's classified as if he sold the principal but maintained the Perot rights for himself. So that's the alternate girsa that the Rabbeinu Tam brings down. Though the Baal HaBeit HaTosafot writes, Ve'im mit yashev deri girsato. The Rebbe doesn't like the girsa of the Rabbeinu Tam, but rather he supports the girsa that we have in our Gemaras, and that they argue on Rav Huna Ba'avin's position. And they hold like Rav Huna, which is that if you take away the money here, the contract stands independently. And the Rebbe explains that their position is premised on what Rav Huna said before, which is that even though you want to expose the capital, the shtar should stand on its own. Once you have a shtar in place, even if you drop the money from the transaction, the shtar could generate the acquisition. So similarly over here, even if he's going to expose the capital or trying to find that missing money that he thinks she is hiding, so now the money gets taken out of the transaction here because the money wasn't used for a purchase, rather to expose it. Nevertheless, since she has a shtar in hand, that shtar is enough evidence to generate the transaction. So why is it written as a shtar mecher then, if it really was a matana, because no money was being given, there was no consideration being given? The answer is, Le'apot et kocha will say that it was written as a shtar mechira in order to strengthen her position, even though it really was a matana. So that is the logic behind this position of Rabbi Abba, Rabbi Abo, and the Chog Dole Ador. Or the assumption is, according to the Rashbam, that this woman probably doesn't have money. And therefore, when he wrote a shtar mechira, we're going to interpret that shtar mechira is being a shtar matana, because of the fact that it's unlikely that a sale actually took place because she doesn't have assets of her own. And that's why we assume it is a matana and reinterpret the mechira and the shtar to be a mechira liapotet kocha. Now, how strong a matana this is actually a machloket in the Rishonim, as to whether this is a matana that she can transact in, she could sell the property, she could do with it what she likes, and when she passes away, that her Yerushim would inherit it, and not the husband himself. That's the way the Ramah views it, that the sale or the matana is such a full-fledged matana that the husband has completely removed himself from the property. On the other hand, the majority of the Rishonim believe that the matana over here is a gift for her to utilize, but not a gift for her to transact in, and not a gift to preclude his ownership of it when she passes away. And that the husband inherits the property when she passes away, like any other piece of property that the wife has. This property, she just has fuller ownership in it because she has both principal and payroll ownership. And it doesn't mean that he loses it in the Yerusha. And if she predeceases him, he will inherit it, and he can even take it away from those individuals who she sold the property to. So now, Amar Rav, Mukhersa del Ishto, Kanta. Person who sells a field to his wife, she acquires it, Vabal Ochel Peirot. And the Baal has a right to eat Peirot. This is similar to what Rav Huna Ba'avin said. Bimatana, if he gives it to her as a gift, Kanta, Vena Baal Ochel Peirot. Then she does acquire it, but then the husband has no rights to the Peirot because he gave it to her as a matana rather than a mecher. Rabbi Lazar Amar, Blazer argues and says, Echad ze, v'echad ze, kanta, v'ena balo chel perot. In both instances, there is an acquisition by the woman to the exclusion of the husband, in that she now owns the property enough to block him from taking the perot. And that's whether it was done as a mecher or a matana. Or in essence, Rabbi Lazar is like the position of Rabbi Abba, Rabbi Abau, and the Chol Gedolei Hador. So it says, Avad Rav Chista uvda ki Rabbi Elazar. Rav Chista had a case, and in that case, he followed the position of Rabbi Elazar. So Amrulei, it's not clear here what the girsa is, whether it's Rabban Ukva v'Rabban Nechemia b'nei brate d'Rav, Rabban, or is it Rabbana Ukva and Rabbana Nechemia, the grandchildren through his daughter of Rav. So these were grandchildren of Rav who obviously were offended that Rav Chista took up the position of Rabbi Elazar, neged their grandfather Rav. So they were his grandchildren through his daughter. So now they asked Rav Chista, Shavakmar Rav Ravei v'Avid Kizutre, you left the big guns and went with the small peanuts, meaning that you left Rav's position and you subscribed to the position of Rabbi Elazar. The point that they're making is that the machloket over here is not on equal footing. Rav is considered to be the Morad Atra of Bavel, and he has a very strong standing in terms of psak halacha, that the halacha should follow Rav. The individuals that are arguing on him are Rabbi Elazar, and then up above we have Rabbi Abba and Rabbi Abau v'chol gdolei ador. So now Rabbi Abba and Rabbi Abau v'chol gdolei ador are all tamidim of Rabbi Yochanan. So they are clearly on the same level, probably a lower level than Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar is also a talmid of Rabbi Yochanan, but he's a talmid chover of Rabbi Yochanan, so he has a higher status. He argues on his Rebbe in many instances. Though Rabbi Abba and Rabbi Abau are just regular talmidim of Rabbi Yochanan. So now, if you are comparing Rabbi Elazar to Rav, then you can't have any machloket over here. Rav would clearly be the governing halacha over here, because Rav is the superstar, is the big gun, and Rabbi Elazar and all these other Amoraim will not hold a candle to Rav. Now we know that Rabbi Elazar's Rebbe, Rabbi Yochanan, even though he was slightly younger than Rav, because again we know the story that Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish are discussing the fact that when they were whippersnappers in Rabbi's Shir, Rav was in the front and he was a big gun. So they were a little younger than Rav.
As the Rashbam points out that Rabbi Yochanan respected Rav as the Morad Atra of Bavel. And he gave him respect as such because he was younger than Rav. Nevertheless, because Rabbi Yochanan was the Morad Atra of Eretz Yisrael, given his stature, we have a principle that Rabbi Rabbi Yochanan, halacha ki Rabbi Yochanan. So it's one thing if Rav and Rabbi Yochanan are arguing to say the psak halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan. But now that Rav is arguing with Rabbi Elazar, or the other individuals that are tamidim of Rabbi Yochanan, there you can't say that they trump Rav.
that they have a higher standing than Rav. It's one thing to say the Rebbe has a higher standing, Rabbi Yochanan, but to say his Talmidim have that standing is not the case. And so the grandchildren of Rav were challenging Rav Chista's psak as to why he didn't follow Rav. So he answers, Amar Lahu, he said back to them, Ananami Karab Rebbe Abde, I have a backing of a big gun as well. Techiata Rabin and Rabbi Yochanan. Because when Rabin came from Eretz Yisrael, he brought a memra from Rabbi Yochanan. Again, this happens all over Shas. We have individuals bringing memra from Rabbi Yochanan in Eretz Yisrael, because Rabbi Yochanan is a big gun in Eretz Yisrael. And here the Talmud Bavli is describing how these memra to Rabbi Yochanan reached Bavel. Echad ze vechad ze kanta veina balo chol peirot. So now you see that Rabbi Elazar's opinion and those of Rabbi Abba and Rabbi Abo all came from Rabbi Yochanan. And it's Rabbi Yochanan's position. So now you have Rav Rabbi Yochanan, halacha to Rabbi Yochanan. Rav Chista says, therefore, I follow the position of Rabbi Yochanan. So now we have the conclusion. Amar Rava Hilchata. This is the halacha. Hamucher sadeh l'ishto lo kanta. Vabal uchel peirot. If he sells a property to his wife, she does not acquire it. Vabal uchel peirot. But the husband gets to eat the production. Those are contradictory statements. If there is no sale, the husband gets everything. What do you mean, eat the peirot? Nothing happened. If he's eating the peirot, that means that she has the underlying principle. B'matana, if he gives it as a gift, kanta, then she is successful at acquiring it. V'nabal uchel peirot. The husband then does not get the right to peirot. So that is muskam nakol. Even Rav agrees that in the case where it's a gift, that the gift is given in the most generous fashion, and the husband leaves no residual rights with himself. Amar asks, tarte, you have a stira in the first statement of Rava. Lokasha, kan b'maot munim, kan b'maot shenem t'munim. Depends on what type of cash surfaced to purchase the property. Tamar Rav Yehuda, maot t'munim. If these were undiscovered cash, this was money that the husband did not know about, then lo kanta. She's unsuccessful at acquiring the property, because it's clear there that the ploy was to discover the cash. He was trying to get the cash. The fact that she showed up with the cash, he got exactly what he wanted. He found the hidden cash now. On the other hand, ma'ot she'enan t'munim, if it's money that the husband is aware of, meaning the wife has ownership over monies independent of her husband, then kanta. She has the ability to acquire the property. In that case, ochel peirot, the husband would eat the peirot. Or in essence, what Rav is doing is passing like Rav with a qualification, which is, he's passing like Rav, Rav Huna Bar Avin, and Rav Nachman, all who say that when there is a sale to the wife, the sale goes through, and it's considered to be a binding sale. In addition, we say the sale is binding to the effect that she gets the principal amount, but the peirot remain with the baal. The only exception or qualification to that is, as long as the cash was known about. The cash that she's using to purchase it was well known. If the cash was not known about it, then that raises the ante that the transaction is not a real transaction, but rather use it as a ploy or fiction to discover the hidden cash. And therefore, we would apply the principle of Ligluye Zuze in order to reveal the cash that was hidden. All right. Tana Banan. Ein mikablim piktonot, lo min anashim, velo min anavadim, velo min tinokot. You may not accept deposits from a woman, from a slave, or from young children. The assumption being here is that whatever they're depositing with you, they're trying to hide either from their husband, from their master, or the tanim over here, or tinokot, or it seems to be orphans that are living with a foster family. And so our assumption is that they likely absconded with this property, and now we're trying to hide it, so they're depositing it with you. So you shouldn't accept the deposit because, as the Rashbam says, we don't want you to be misayeya la ovrei avera. Kibel mina isha, if he did accept it, even though you're not supposed to, if you did accept it from her, yakzir the isha, you return it to the woman. V'im meita, if she passes away, yakzir the bala, we give it back to her husband. So here, first of all, if you accept it from the woman, we're not going to assume that the property is stolen without evidence of it being stolen. Before she gives it to you, we have suspicions. So in order not to be aiding and abetting a crime where the woman is stealing from her husband, don't accept the deposit without her husband's knowledge. But if you already accepted it, then we're not, without evidence, we're not going to assume that she really did steal it. And if she asks for it back, we give it back to her. The truth is, if she also told us to give it to a third party, we would listen to her as well. As the Baal HaTzvot says, she has a migo. The migo is that if she says, return it to me, you return it to her. She tells you to go give it to a third party, then you give it to the third party. Because otherwise, she could have just taken it herself and given it to the third party. And even if the husband says, that's my money, still we would listen to her and give it to the third party because she could have taken the money for herself. Just like she could have taken it for herself, she has the right to give it to a third party, and her husband has no rights over here. Although the Baal Yitzchak point out that im takafa Baal, if the Baal took him away from Yada, shuvena yochola leotziam yado. She doesn't have a way to get out of his hands and to say they belong to so-and-so, because then she's lost her migo in some sense, and she's not in a minute to say they belong to the third party when the husband has taken them away. On the other hand, if these were pieces of property or money that were well known and on the table beforehand, if the husband confiscates them or grabs them away from her, there she would have a right to take them back, because over there, there isn't suspicion about the fact that these were properties that belonged to a third party, or she was hiding these properties because she left them in the open. She didn't hide them from her husband. Given that, in all likelihood, they really do belong to her. And if that's the case, she can demand the return of those properties from her husband if he takes them away from her. If she passes away, it goes to her husband. That's for two reasons. Number one is that a husband inherits his wife. And therefore, if the property really was his wife's independent property, then it would go to him anyway because he's entitled to inherit his wife. Number two is we do have suspicions that the property was stolen from the husband. Even though we can't prove it and we won't act on it, that suspicion is still there. So that's another reason to give it to the husband. Now, even though there's a third possibility, which is this was somebody else's property that was deposited with the woman, but given that that is a minority chance that that was the case, and the chazakah lies with the husband, therefore we grant it to the husband upon the passing of the wife. Kibel min ha'eved, if he accepted it from a slave, yachzir le'eved, then he gives it back to the eved. V'imate, if the eved passes away, yachzir le'rabo, you give it back to his owner. So here again, you have the same setup, which is that if the eved gives it to you, you return it to the eved, because even though we have suspicions that an eved might be a gazlan, and stam avadim are gazlanim, hey? Nevertheless, we don't have any evidence or proof of that, so if he gave it to you, you have to give it back to him. And similarly, if he asks you to give it to a third party, you give it to them because migo, that he could do it himself, you do it on his behalf. And the mate, if he passes away, it goes to the master, for the same reasons that we said by the woman as well, which is number one, kumashikana eved kana rabo, so his master has ownership rights over here. Number two is that we did suspect that it could be gezel and it would have belonged to the master anyway. So given that it's only a minor possibility that this belonged to another party, in that instance we don't worry about it and we give it back to the master. The question comes up in an instance where the woman got divorced from the husband or the eved was freed from his master. In that case, what do we do upon the death of the individual? So the Rashbam brings over here that Mir Reinai, do it again im nishtachera eved, v'achar kach meit, yachzir l'rabo. That if the eved was free, and then he passes away, you don't give it back to the eved or his yorshim, you give it back to the master. By the isha, if she gets divorced from her husband, and then passes away, you give it to the inheritors of the woman, and not to the husband. So here the Rashbam differentiates between a woman and an eved. In a case where the woman was divorced, or in the case where the eved is freed, then when they pass away, the outcomes are different. By the woman, when she passes away, you don't give it to the husband, you give it to her yorshim. In the case of the eved, you still give it to the master. And the Rashbam explains the reason being, because stam avadim gazlanim hay. Stam avadim are thieves, and so therefore we suspect that all along that the property really belonged to the Baal. So even after the eved was freed, we still have that suspicion lingering in the background. And given that, we give it back to his master. On the other hand, by an isha, we don't have that suspicion. And therefore, we assume that the woman had independent ownership somehow here, or a third party gave her the ownership. And since now she's divorced and she's an independent entity, you have to return it to her as an independent entity, not to the Baal. By the eved, where he was a slave at the time of the deposit, in all likelihood, he got possession of it through gezel. In that case, we will favor the adon, the death of the eved. That is the position of the Rishbam. But there are Rishonim, like the Rabbeinu Tam, that disagree with the Rishbam and believe that an eved and an isha have the exact same din. Once the eved is freed, he's like a woman who's divorced and he has independent ownership, and he would have to return it to the eved or to his yorshim. Or if the eved who's freed has no yorshim, then the person holding it will take possession of it because it became hefker, and he was the first machzik in the property, so he wouldn't have to return it to anyone in that case. Kibel min ha-katan. Now, if you accepted the property from the Katan, yaselo skula. You should make it into something that is everlasting or has duration for him. Vimate, if he passes away, yakzir li yoshav. Then you give it to the inheritors of the Katan. So now over here, by the Katan, we do not return it to the house, his fostering house, or whoever he is living with, because we assume that somehow he came into possession of the item. Rabbi Tosafot point out here, Mishaba liyado imor mitziah ashkach. Once the Katan gives it to the Shomer to watch on his behalf, then even though until this point we would assume it was stolen merchandise, once it's given, we come up with a possible story as to how it wasn't stolen merchandise. And that is to say that it was an Aveda that he found, and he has a kinyan on it, midrabanan. Now, as long as he's a Katan, unlike the Isha and the Eved, when they demand it, we return it to them. Over here, by the Katan, we do not return it to him. Now, why, when he asks for it back, do we not give it back to him? So the Rashbam says that there's a technical problem, which is that he is a Katan. And he has no idea how to take care of this property. And given that, if you return it to him, it's holeich le'ibud. It's as if you're throwing it out into the garbage. You are not being a responsible guardian on behalf of the Katan to return him the object that he gave to you, because if you give it back to him, he's going to end up losing it or wasting it. And therefore, you as the protector of the Katan should act to the benefit or on behalf of the Katan. And therefore, you should invest it in something that is lasting or has duration to it, rather than give it back to the Katan. The Rabbeinu Gershon, on the other hand, says that the problem is, ein yachol lachzir lo lefish ein yad the Katan. It's a halachic problem, which is that the Katan has no means of acquisition halachically. Ela yaselo mimenu skula. So the Rashbam says it's a technical problem, which is that the Katan is not a responsible party. So you are irresponsible in giving it to this Katan, and therefore to be a responsible party, you can't give it back to him. The other hand, the Rabbeinu Gershom says you can't give it back to him because he doesn't have any halachic rights of ownership or acquisition, and so you can't get it into his possession. So given that, you instead make it into a skula. And others who say it's just good advice, that even though you could return it to the Katan, just a bad idea. And so if you're going to do something to the benefit of the Katan, once he's given you the item, at least help him out, and just a piece of good advice. V'kulan shamru b'shat mitatan, and any of these individuals on their deathbed that make a declaration, shall ploni hein yaseh keperushan, when they say it belonged to so-and-so, you do whatever they said to you. You do as they are indicating, because we assume that they are telling you the truth. Now, that could be for a number of reasons. Either because, one, they're on their deathbed. And people on their deathbed don't lie. That is the view of the Yerushalmi. Obviously, our Gemara doesn't believe that, as you can see here, that we question the veracity of their statements over here, unlike the Yerushalmi, who seems to indicate that they would be believed on their deathbed. On the other hand, the Rashbam says over here that Mishad Mitatan is Orcha de Milta Nakat. Just a normal case, because that's when they tend to be instructing people to do things, because while they're still alive, if they want to return it to their owners, they could do it themselves. The only reason that they're asking someone else is because now they're incapacitated, and that's most likely in a situation in which they are on their deathbed. Now, over here, by the time of death, the Balei Tosafot point out before that you lose the migo, because she can no longer say, I would have taken it from you and handed it to the third party, but rather, you have to rely on this individual, the shomer, to give it to the third party. She loses her migo there because she's incapable of doing it herself. So then, that's where we have the locha that you have to think about whether we believe her or don't believe her. In the case before, where she told us to give it to a third party, we believe her because of the migo, because she could have done it herself. Over here, where she's incapable of doing it herself, she no longer has a migo, and there we have to balance between the interest of the husband or other parties versus giving it to the person that she indicates it belongs to. Bim laf. If not, yaseh perush the perusham. Then you should interpret that which they said. So the im lav here is difficult. The way that the Rabbeinu Gershom learns it is that im lav, im lo pershu. If they didn't explain who it belongs to, then in that case, you try to figure out. You look into the matter and figure out who it does belong to. Before you give it back to the baal, the adon, you should look into the matter and figure out where it should go and whether it really belongs to them or belongs to a third party. That's the way the Rabbeinu Gershom learns it. In lav, according to the Rashbam, is if you do not believe them. If you don't believe that which they are saying, then you should try to figure out what should really be done with it. Not give it to these individuals, but rather give it back to the husband or the adon. You have to investigate, and you have to look into the matter if you don't believe them. So even though they've stated unequivocally that it belonged to a third party, you don't necessarily believe them because they're just saying that it's not mine. They're too embarrassed to say who it really belonged to, so they kind of say it belonged to this third party. But if you don't believe them, then you have to look into the matter and return it to the person you think is the rightful owner of this property. The Rashbam rejects the view of the Rabbeinu Gershom and says that it would be then duplicative in this Braita to say in lav if they didn't explain it. If they didn't explain it, the Braita already told us what you do and who it goes to. So therefore, that is already covered. To say be in lav doesn't make any sense. But then the Rashbam brings a third version of this, which is that some Rishonim had the girsa of the Ikid de Amre. There are some that say, Yaseh Perush, the Perushan. Meaning that this is an alternate view as to what you do over here. One view is that when they explicitly state something, you do as they say. Ikid de Amre, some say, no, you do not do what they say, but rather you determine what you think is the right location. And the Rashbam rejects this as well. Velona Hira, he says it doesn't make sense. Dimkein Rav, Damar, Im Hemenlach. Rav, who's about to pass an halacha, who does he hold like over here? Because then he's not like the Reisha or the Seifa of the Braita. The Bitu, the Barba Barbachana, the wife of Rabbi Barbachana, Kika Shachva, on her deathbed, she said, Amra, Hani Kipe, these, the way that the Rashbam brings it over here, is that these are earrings. Although as the Masorat HaShas points out, that in other places in Shas, Rashi explained that they were Nizamim, they were nose rings. But either way, it's some form of jewelry that they belong to Marta Ubnei Brato. The way that the Rashbam reads it is Marta is a Talmud Chacham, who's the brother of Rabbi Chia, according to the Rashbam, who was actually the uncle of Rabbi Barbarchana. It belongs to this Talmud Chacham, Ubnei Brato, and his grandson through his daughter. So those are the owners of these pieces of jewelry. Please return them to them. Others suggest that Marta was Rabbi Barbarchana's wife. And when she said that they belong to Marta, Ubnei Brata, they belong to her and her grandson, meaning that she had children from another marriage, or she was indicating they were hers and she was passing them to her grandson. Or the Rabbeinu Gershom says, the Marta shall Eshet Ploni. They belong to so-and-so's wife, Ubnei Brata, and her grandchild. He says that's an independent party, not his own wife. What she's declaring, seemingly, is that these were deposited with her and they belong to these other individuals. Ata the kamei de Rav. So Rabbi Barbarchana went to Rav to clarify what he should do in this case. Amarle, im hemen lach, if you believe her, asei k'perusha, do what she said. Vilo, and if you don't believe her, asei perush, the perusha. Then interpret what she said or figure out what she really meant or whether she really owned these independently, and you make a decision whether you should give it to these parties or keep them for yourself. So Rav, in essence, is doing is passing like the Braita that we just brought over here. And that's why the Rashbam says that the reading that we have in the Braita and the Girsa that we have in our Gemara seems to make the most sense, because then Rav is passing exactly like the Braita that we had over here. V'iga damre, hachi, amarle. There are some that say, no, this is what Rav said to Rabbi Barchana. I'amidalach, asei k'peirusha. If you think they were wealthy, then do what she said. Velo, if not, asei perush the perusha. Otherwise, then try to figure out what she meant or take it for yourself because you don't believe her. The Rashbam here brings two possibilities of what it means, i'amidalach. One is that if the people that she said deposited these items with her, if they are wealthy enough to have this type of jewelry, then abide by her instructions because it would make sense. These wealthy individuals deposited these items with her because she was trustworthy, and now return them to them. But if these individuals don't seem like they have the means by which to own jewelry like this, then you have to figure out what she really meant, or keep it for yourself because it doesn't make sense. That's one possibility. Or the other possibility is, i'amidalach, if your wife was independently wealthy, meaning that she had assets of her own, by which she could have purchased these items or brought these items into her possession, then you believe her because she had the means by which to acquire these types of items. And that means that they were hers and now she's gifting them to someone else. So she's entitled to do that. On the other hand, if she didn't have enough independent wealth where people had gifted her items independent of her husband, then don't believe her because she didn't have the means to acquire this, and the only way she came into possession of them was by taking your property or stealing from you. And then the Gemara ends here, Mina Katanya Selo Skula. You receive a deposit from Katan, you should make it into a skula, something that is a long-lasting asset. My skula. What is a skula? We saw this together in the Gemara and Baba Kama on Daf Pei Zayin. Chista Amar Sefer Torah. Should purchase for him a Sefer Torah. As the Rashbam points out, Akeren Kayemet. The core item or principle stays intact. Valperot is that you can learn from the Sefer Torah. So it's an item that has immediate benefit and benefit that you can garner from it, but it preserves the underlying principle. Others point out that it doesn't have to literally be a Sefer Torah. It could be Sfarim or Sifrei Kodesh, something where the inherent item remains intact, but there is benefit from its utilization currently. Rabba Barav Huna Amar Dikla D'Acha Mina Tamre. That it is, you should invest it in a palm tree, and you can eat the dates in the interim. I mean, it's something that produces fruit, but the principal amount, the tree, remains intact. So in essence, what the recommendation of a skula is that you should invest in something where the principal will remain intact, and it has dividends that are paid from it, whether it's the fruits from the palm tree, it's the learning that you get from a Sefer Torah, it has underlying principal value that is maintained, plus it has productive value, which gives you an output or a current stream of income from that item. And as the Rashbam points out, that the Gemara is really coming here to exclude a case of iska. Don't invest it in a business where the principal is at risk. We don't want you risking the principal. We want you preserving the principal. But in preservation of the principal, we'd also like you to garner income from the principal that is being held on his behalf. I assume they mentioned the dikla because both of its longevity, as well as the fact that the palm tree and the wood of the palm tree was also valuable at the end. So given that, it would have principal amount preserved in it, besides the production of the fruit. Other trees, even if they can be used for firewood, it's not as expensive a wood necessarily, and therefore maybe there you would say you can't use it. So it might be that it's a palm tree or something similar to a palm tree, but not necessarily all fruit trees would qualify in this case. All right, we're going to stop here, and the two dots in the middle of Nun Bet, Amud Aleph.